Blue Monkey.
Rob RHXFT.
Fatinus.
El Justo.
Balthazar.
Podcast Focus Civilization 3.
Hello, this is Bruce, known on the forum as Blue Monkey.
Hello, this is Rob, known on the forum as Rob RHXFT.
I'm Jonathan, and I'm known on the forum as Plotinus.
Hey, I'm Johnny O. People know me as El Justo.
It's pronounced.
Okay, El Justo, that's the Spanish pronunciation, right?
I've always thought of it as El Justo.
Right. You're not the first one.
Oh, embarrassing. I shouldn't have admitted to that, should I?
Okay.
It'll be in the final cut, that.
I'm sure it will.
When I talked to Poldicon on Skype, I've talked to him a number of times on there. He helped me out a lot with some of the projects that I did in the past, and I've corrected him a handful of times. I said, it's Justo, Spanish, say it, Justo, and he insists on calling it Justo, so I've given up trying to, but he says it in good humor. I think he's just needling me a little bit, but...
He does have that sense of humor.
My name's Parker in real life. I live in Cincinnati. There's a scene in the new Spider-Man where he's fighting the lizard and there's an older guy in the foreground listening to music. I would be that guy.
You are Stan Lee, right?
Yeah. I'd like to think so.
I'm born and raised in California.
I've got that Hey Dude surfer accent, which I didn't know I had until I moved to Manhattan.
And then when I moved back to California, I got accused of being a snob because I had that New York accent.
Right.
And so I end up trying to use BBC accent that they teach American newscasters now.
Do they? They don't. Really? Yes. They're not doing a very good job.
No. It's supposed to be the most bland, understood over the whole world American version of a British accent, and it just sounds artificial.
Yeah, I'll accept terrific as well.
Yeah.
Transatlantic accent.
Yeah, that's it, the transatlantic accent.
There you go.
Sounds like somebody that's on a cruise ship and never comes to land. I think it would be interesting to know why we picked the forum names we did.
Yeah, I like that. I can give you a little explanation on mine.
Yeah,
it's
please.
In Spanish, the word justo means righteous. And I was just being facetious, in a sense.
Okay, good, good. You
know? But I just want everybody to know, I guess for the podcast, that justo is an adjective, and in Spanish it means righteous.
Nice to have it cleared up.
Well, with me, initially, RHXFT was a way of me being on the, not the forum, but online with somebody else where nobody else would know who it was if they're looking over. So it was Rob 8 Cross Flats Terrace, which was an old address of mine.
There you go.
So that's where it was, and it just, it's a unique one. I wanted to have Rob for the forum name, just as Rob, but somebody had actually beaten to it. I know we visited Cinematics once, so it's a shame that it got used for somebody who would never return, but there we go.
I like it, Rob. You just unlocked a decade-long mystery.
I study, well, among other things, late antiquity, and so I just grabbed the first name I could think of a famous person from late antiquity, so Plotinus. I think actually I wanted to be Origen first, but someone had taken that already. I mean, these days I normally use my own name when I go online, but I've been stuck with it for so long now in the civilization world that there's not much I can do about it, I think.
And it's the first time I've heard it pronounced that way. I'd always thought of you as Plotinus.
Yeah, that's probably a more accurate pronunciation. I think in the Greek it would be something like Plotinos, but in English the usual pronunciation is Plotinus.
Only in England. In America.
Yes, only in Plotinus. England. Yeah. I hear English fellows say urinal, and it takes me back a little bit. It's,
well, yeah, that is
I guess in the States we call it urinal.
Interesting simile to Plotinus' name.
Yeah, I'll choose not to be offended by that.
Yeah.
Pardon me, Jonathan. I didn't mean to make a correlation.
Okay, Blue Monkey, kind of an interesting origin for me. I tend to like multi-level puns, kind of Umberto Eco type of thing. I was one of those RH babies that was born blue, and I was born in the year of the monkey. I tend to have that kind of Hanuman Monkey King thing where I joke around and sometimes people take it seriously. So that's Blue Monkey also. And then there's the jazz and blues thing. I think Jonathan and I have texted about that before a little bit. Ooh. And so the monkey speaks his mind. I don't know, Jonathan, if you know that one. That's from the 1940s. It's one of the first rap songs.
Ah, right. Okay. Right. So,
awesome. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. Dave Bartholomew, who produced Chubby Checkers, amongst other people's.
Oh, yeah, and Fat Domino. He wrote most of Fat Domino's songs. I didn't know that.
Right.
Yeah, I'll look that up.
It's a monkey talking about how man devolved, so he obviously did not come from monkeys.
Yep. You're a self-deprecating fellow, Bruce. I like that.
came from something to do with India for some reason.
Yes, Hanuman. I'm not Indian, but I have a strong interest in Indian mythology. I've got that mod that I've been working on. I've been working on it since Civ 2 days. So,
wow.
I don't know if I hold the record for the longest mod that's never seen the light of day, but...
There are a lot of contenders for that crown, I think.
How we got into modding.
I started out doing some stuff for the Native American mod 10 or 11 years ago with a guy called Unexisted. He was only around for a short while, and somebody who knew far better, Sword of Geddon, collaborated on that project. Unexisted introduced me to Poser 5, so I could make my own leaderheads. So for a while, I was kind of a leaderhead creator more than anything else. Very influential to me. Was Utah Jazz 7? The number of units that he'd done are sensational. And, of course, his conforming figures that he did that we could add to.
Yeah, it was great work at the time, for sure.
Fantastic. And of course, the tutorial that he did. From him, his tutorial, I started doing units. So I don't know if you guys remember, certainly in the earlier days of Civ 3, people only did one sort of element of modding, it seems. So the people who did leaderheads, the people who did units, the people who did buildings. So I wanted to do a bit more than that and try and do every sort of element, which is why I started doing Anno Domini. And obviously I've done several iterations of that along the way, and I'm now doing a version 4 Civ 5.
Do you mod Civ 4 as well? Like, do you go back and forth between 3 and 4?
No, I did a couple of leaderheads for Civ 4. And I mooted about doing Anno Domini 4 Civ 4, but nobody was really that interested in it. If I started up a thread, just sit there, and nobody would respond. So I just thought there wasn't the appetite for a mod like that, certainly at that time.
Interesting.
And I came back to Civ 3, where people were very much up for another version of Anno Domini, so I did that. Case of partly catering to my audience, but it was also a case of, why bother going to the lengths of learning new coding and, you know, new systems, etc., when nobody wanted it anyway?
I agree totally. That's part of my sentiment about 4 and 5 and trying to make stuff for that.
I did a version of Anno Domini for Civ 5, pretty much well received. If you add up all the downloads through the different channels, it's had about 20,000, which isn't bad.
Wow.
And so, you know, that sort of spurred me on to do a Brave New World version, which I've been working on today, actually, before the call. Hopefully the full version of that will be out in about a month's time.
Okay, so you're a busy beaver.
Well, unlike the Civ 3 versions, it's got something like 70 or 80 Civs in there.
Oh, wow.
And the Civ 5 community is really buzzing at the moment, so there's lots of people coming out with lots of new ideas, kind of trying to integrate some of those into my mod. Completely different sort of world to Civ 3 modding, I would say. How did you get into modding then, John?
I guess you can go back to the early days about, I'd say, 2002, I think I got my first Civilization game. It was Civilization 2. I got hooked. The turn-based strategy game was so awesome. And in college, I was a history major, so I've always had a pretty keen interest in history. Fast forward about 6 months, and I say, I got to get Civ 3, it's out, and ended up getting Play the World. I fast forward a couple more months, and I got the full Conquest. Absolutely hooked. And I went on to the forums. I found the Civilization Fanatics. It's like a revelation.
Well, I started playing Civ, oh, I don't know, when Civ 1 came out, and then moved to Civ 2 and Test of Time. Then when Civ 3 came out, I couldn't wait to buy it, and I got Civ Complete.
I signed up and saw all the incredible stuff that people made, and I was totally blown away. I didn't even mess with the editor or anything like that with Civ 2 or even when I originally got Civ 3. So I guess I was browsing some of the forums and seeing a lot of the scenarios that were created, and the game to a whole new level for me. I always thought that I could make something even better based on what I saw on the forums. And I guess I reached out for some help in the early days.
You guys remember that guy, Rokotay? He was a really cool guy. When I first started opening up the editor and all the folders and stuff like that, I used to send him messages, and he was always so courteous, and he was an old guy. I don't know if you guys realized that he was in his 70s back then, and I don't know if he's still alive. Probably pushing 80 by now, and he would send me notes periodically saying that he wasn't doing well. But needless to say, he the gold standard for many years in terms of scenarios. So naturally, I tried to lean on him, and he was very generous. And to this day, I still use a lot of the stuff that he says, you know, just organizing everything. And he was a big inspiration for me in terms of keeping at it. And that's really what it is when you're putting together these big projects.
I started with Civ 2 and the flags. The whole idea of the flags, the event flags, was really amazing to me. And then they had a contest. They provided a map of India, and whoever could come up with the best map of India was, I don't know, going to win recognition, I guess, basically. So I decided, because of my interest in India, it's like, okay, I will try that. And then I'm so slow at developing things that Civ 3 came along, and that was Apolliton that had that contest, and I discovered Civ Fanatics. And the community at Civ Fanatics just seemed so vibrant, and everybody, like you were saying about Rokotay, to me seemed like mod gods, you know, like the Eric Claptons of the mod world, and I got scared. So I'm like,
yeah, it is a little daunting when you first come in, for sure.
Yeah, and so I started thinking, well, if I want to do a mod, how can I get all of these amazing people to help me? So I had already been doing some desktop publishing 2D graphics professionally, and I thought, well, it's not too hard to figure out palettes, and tech icons aren't that hard. So that's where I started. And then I had done a little bit of mapping also in the flesh world, the real world. So, okay, I can use the editor and make maps. And I think the first map I did was the Rise of Asia map, and got a lot of compliments on that from people like Yoda Power. So that encouraged me. Civ 4 came out, Civ 5 came out. Rob was talking about moving over to those communities. And I thought about it. I didn't own the games, but I thought about, you know, there's some interesting mods. I would buy the game just for the mod. But then I was thinking, I'm going to lose this community because the people are more important to me than any particular mod. So I guess the main reason I've stuck with the Civ 3 modding community is, number one, I already know how to do this stuff. And then number two, it's because of guys like the three of you.
It's very kind of you.
Oh, I feel affirmed.
I have to say, Rob, I was so disappointed when you betrayed us by going to Civ 4.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed too. That's why I had to bring that up.
I soon turned around and came back to Civ 3 once a week.
Yeah, you do come back. We see you.
I wouldn't say that I, in inverted commas, went to Civ 4. I just tried to go in the water with Civ 4.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you tell yourself that. You tell yourself that.
Oh, no, but I will tell myself that, because one of the first things I thought when I put up the forum thread about Anno Domini for Civ 4, I didn't get the same response as I would have with Civ 3. Because those guys would have at least said, nice to see you trying something out. I got absolutely zilch. Came back to Civ 3, and it was all love and roses again.
That's funny. I've gone through the same thought processes in my head with going to 4 and 5, and when you come back to 3.
It sounds incredible to say this now, but when Civ 4 came out, I was really excited, but I couldn't get it because my computer was not powerful enough to run it.
Yeah, me too.
Yes, yeah. So I never played it. I played a demo of Civ 5. I've not done anything more than that because I just didn't have the time. Things have moved on since then. I get the impression that Civ 4 and Civ 5 have been kind of bigger releases in the gaming world than the earlier ones. You know, they made a bigger splash. And so there are more people, more younger people in particular.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a Wild West aspect for sure.
Yeah, for sure. But I should say, though, I'm surprised to hearing so many people talk about Civ 2 as the old days. I remember Civ 1. I played that when I was a teenager. I must have been doing A-levels, because I think it came out in around about 1991 or 2 or thereabouts.
Right.
I would have been about 15 or 16 or something like that. And I played that constantly. It captivated me. I mean, by today's standards, it was a pretty primitive game and wildly unrealistic. I mean, every game I ever played ended with me basically becoming a democracy and then buying the whole of the rest of the world, because you could just buy other cities, well, apart from their capitals. You had to go to war for that bit.
That might seem unusual for people in Britain today, but in America, that's pretty much what we do.
Well, I guess so. You know, that was Civ 1's way of modeling a cultural conquest. But after that, I stopped playing games altogether for quite a few years, so I missed Civ 2. And it was years later when I thought, I wonder if there's still a Civilization game going, and was Civ 3 at that time. It must have been the fairly early days of Civ 3 because the expansions hadn't yet come out. And I was amazed by how technologically advanced it looked. But I love the scenarios. I remember stumbling across fan-made scenarios of the Politan. I was amazed. There was one in particular. I don't remember what it was called or who did it, but it was set in Byzantium. And I was astounded by that, you know. I thought, it's amazing. People have made things just like come with the game. So I thought I'd have a go at it. That's what I did. When I stumbled across VSC and I found people were actively discussing it and there was masses and masses of materials you could use that people had made, I joined up and I sort of stayed there and seemed not to have left. It's a long time. It's just as you start off playing and then you start modding it and you find that's more fun. Similarly, I found that making stuff for other people to mod turned out to be more fun than actually modding myself. And so I found myself just making units, you know, and I love the artistic challenge of doing that. So that's my tale. I have an interest, I suppose, in history because I'm an academic. Well, no, it's true. I'm an academic, but I'm a historian of ideas. You know, I'm a philosopher. So I'm not a historian of the real world or anything that actually happened. I only know about books. My first scenario I made, it was the Anglo-Saxon scenario, the Rood and the Dragon. And the reason I made it, actually, I was inspired by the Firaxis Sengoku scenario, the one set in the Warring States period in Japan. Is it called Warring States? That's China, isn't it? You see, that's right. How ignorant I am of history. And when I saw that, in fact, described before it even came out, I thought, that sounds fantastic. I bet they do one set in Anglo-Saxon England, because that's basically the same situation. And I was so disappointed when they didn't. I've got this naive belief that they would. So I thought, well, you know, swab that, I'll make my own. So I did. And I really enjoyed doing it. The most challenging thing I found was looking up stuff from the period. People, events, places.
It's a learning experience, isn't it, Jonathan?
It is indeed. And I was kind of into it because a friend of mine years earlier had been chucking out all his stuff because he was moving away. And one of the things I got from him was a big book about the Anglo-Saxons. So I just read it. That's how I knew about it. But the challenging and the interesting thing was not just learning the stuff, but working out how to turn it into game mechanics. So here, for example, the book Beowulf. So what do I do with that? Do I make a unit called Beowulf? Do I make a great wonder called Beowulf? Do I make a technology called Beowulf or something like that? I found that a real challenge taking these real things and working out how they work together as game mechanics, especially in a game like Civilization 3, where you don't have very much control over the mechanic, how the game works. You know, there's no scripting or anything like that. So you are kind of stuck with a fairly limited palette of tools of ways to make these things work. I liked trying to find ways to use mechanics in a slightly different way or unexpected way. So, I mean, one thing I did with that scenario that anyone who's played it will have probably complained to me about because so many people didn't like it was I used the cultural victory idea. So, as we know, in the main game, you can win a cultural victory if you amass sufficient cultural points you've got at least double the cultural points for your nearest rival. And so I used that not as something a player could do, but as a challenge by making one of the other civilizations, namely Ireland, have a massive cultural lead. And so it would win a cultural victory unless you could be at least half its cultural points by the time it reached the relevant stage. And I thought that was an interesting way of kind of modeling the fact that there was lots of stuff going on in Ireland and they were advancing in their kinds of philosophical and theological ideas at the time. They produced Origena, the great Irish philosopher, and so on. And I don't think anyone had ever done something quite like that before, but it was a way of using the tools we had. It seemed to work, so I got over clever with the second scenario, which was the desert and the mountains. So this was set in medieval North Africa. And that was an interest I had from my church history sort of background, I suppose. I edited and mostly wrote an enormous book, a sort of overview of church history. And I was doing that while I was doing the Anglo-Saxon scenario. So I just recently finished that, but all was in the final stages of like the final drafts and copy editing. When I was working on that book, I was really struck by the story of Christianity in ancient and medieval Africa, not modern Africa. So I thought, let's make a scenario out of it. Again, I thought, you know, let's try and find new ways of using existing mechanics. And I did it in a very intricate and sort of elaborate way.
I'm curious about this. For all these years, as an historian, I took a lot of classes and research and all that.
Oh, yeah.
How did you find, what was your base of research for that stuff? I mean, I always wanted to know that because, man, you're digging deep, bro.
Well, I did my best. It was not easy. I can tell you, it would be, well, maybe you'd be surprised, maybe you wouldn't, how little information there is in the English language on a lot of that stuff. It was difficult. I mean, I went to the British Library. I was living in London at the time, and I was doing a lot of research there anyway. So I went and sat, and I ordered up everything I could on a lot of this stuff. And some of it, I mean, there was pitifully little, and what there was pretty obscure and published by weird little presses you've never heard of, and that if you didn't have stuff like the British Library to hand.
I want to jump in and make a comment related also to the modding community. I honestly don't remember who it was, but I remember at one point having a discussion on the forums with someone that accused you of making a fantasy scenario because one of the amazing units you made was the Ark of the Covenant. And there was this special victory for Ethiopia that had to do with the Ark of the Covenant.
It was Beta Israel.
Yes.
One of their special victories was destroying these icons held by Ethiopians. Yeah, yes. One of which was the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes. So someone accused you of making a fantasy scenario, but it was obvious from their comments that they weren't aware of that whole aspect of the particular church that's in Ethiopia that the fringe historians say was founded by the Templars and all that sort of thing.
This is how people learn. That's one of the things I really like about something like Civilization and about something like these scenarios we've made, because we've all made things that reflect our own interests. I've had people comment, particularly on The Ruse and the Dragon, the Anglo-Saxon scenario, that playing it opened their eyes to a sort of world that they didn't know about. And, you know, people have said, I've gone and bought a book to look into this more. And I think that's fantastic. And that's why I made it. These are great stories. They're great worlds. And we like to share them.
One thing that I've said before in the Civ 5 community, that people that are looking for city lists, for entries, for Civilopedia items, just need to go back to see what we did in Civ 3, because whilst the game's changed, history never has.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know, all the information that were put in those old games is still true. You know, I think people forget that sometimes.
John, you should talk about the challenges you face with your scenarios, because the number of downloads and I think the number of posts on your threads kind of outweigh everyone else's put together. I've never seen such consistently popular scenarios right from the word go. I mean, it's amazing the amount of interest and excitement and love for your scenarios you've managed to maintain over a very long time.
Those are kind words. Thanks, Jonathan.
It's also one of the most complex scenarios and I think really pushes the game engine.
Yeah, there are some elements where we kind of push them. The Age of Imperialism is my little baby. I did an undergraduate thesis in college on the Philippine-American War.
spent probably a good year and a half or so really digging into a lot of primary resources, and I even went down to the Library of Congress in D.C. and looked at microfiche and all that stuff. I really immersed myself in that era, and it's a very little-known era of American history, number one. That time in American history really captivated my imagination. During the course of doing the research, kind of like the way Jonathan said when he was immersed in his scholastic endeavors, you can kind of get a little preve or like a getaway when you dive into the civ stuff. So it went hand in hand. When I was doing the research, I was kind of formatting how I would lay out a scenario with the United States at the turn of the 20th century, period in which America kind of rose up on the international scene. And it started with the war with Spain. And I guess to get back to the Philippine-American War, it was kind of intertwined with that. So I guess as far as my research and design went for the scenario, it evolved over time. I made several versions of the scenario, and the first one was extremely rudimentary. There was a guy who actually made and titled it Age of Imperialism. I'm trying to think of the username, but I remember messaging with him. He wasn't around very long, and I told him that I would help him with it. He told me, I can't do this anymore. Take it over. You do whatever you want with it, prior to my first version. But let me fast forward to the point where I try to organize everything. It's can't put into words how daunting it is to get a scenario of this scale organized. And it took me probably a good year and a half to really harness everything with the spreadsheets and the overall game mechanics. As layered as it may seem, and despite what a lot of people might suggest, I did want to try to keep the game as basic as possible. And as basic as possible, I mean build and conquer and not really deviate too far from the base Civilization III game style. That might seem a little rosy to say that, but I guess it would boil down to just building up your empire, putting together armies based on all the different classes of units, and I guess no fluff. That's what Voldicon always used to say to me. He gave me a lot of great feedback in addition to all the graphics he did. I mean, the latest version of AOI surely wouldn't be what it is without him. I've always taken the opinion that come off as kind of crass. I really don't care what people think about it, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, I enjoy putting it together, and the gratification for me is intrinsic. Once I finish it and put it up there, there's a certain element of satisfaction that trumps any kind of, oh, good job, or this is great, from visualization point A to point Z. To have it complete is extremely gratifying.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
We've been talking about scenarios, and I think I have, like, six different scenarios that haven't seen the light of day yet. And with the complexity, for me, one of the hardest things, but one of the most rewarding things at the same time, ever since childhood, I've had this fascination with creating little worlds, and I get really involved in terrain. And I think that's probably the number one stumbling block for me is to take the steampunk Africa scenario, for example. There's probably at least half a dozen terrains that need to be created for that. And there are a lot of questions around that. It might seem really simple, but to take Savannah, for example, do I make that a separate terrain? Do I make that a forest?
Well, I think that's your artist.
Yeah. But also it goes back to my mapping interest, because I see maps sometimes that it's like, doesn't that guy understand there needs to be a rain shadow behind that mountain range? Things like that. And it's even harder with another one of the steampunk scenarios, Scepter and Orbs, which is sort of the steampunk interplanetary romance. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, how do you take this limited palette of terrains that are available and have Mars Barsoom be completely different from Earth and completely different from the moon? Balthazar, you did some amazing things with the maps of Mars.
Flamand was working with outer space maps or something. I just did a map to see how many different types of terrains I could put on one map, and that turned into the basic map for the steampunk mod, the Lost Worlds map. And one of the things I discovered there was that you could actually separate out LM terrain and make it a whole different world than the regular terrain. One thing I noticed when I was working on the interface for the World War II stuff, John's recent project, is that we have a real deficit of advisors. We have hardly any. I had to make military advisors using photos. I've even thought about running a contest for advisors and pop heads.
One of the things I've thought about doing, but another one of those things I never got around to, I forget who did it, but I've seen in a couple of scenarios where people took leader heads and turned them into advisor graphics.
I did that for the steampunk mod using some of Rob's work.
That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, I've done that too, yeah.
Likewise, but what you actually need is some slightly different expressions for the advisors. There's like a shocked expression, for example, that they have, which isn't part of the lead head animation. So I did actually do some advisors somewhere along the line. I think it might have actually been for the first version of Rude and the Dragon. I basically created them as a wood lead heads initially, and then did the static pictures based on the right poses.
Yep, you did. They're still in there. I did the same thing for my Desert on the Mountain one as well. I made the advisors for that myself, and I actually quite enjoyed it. In a way, it's easier than leader heads because you don't have to animate them or anything.
We've got the request for units thread. I don't know if it's still active or not, but at one point there was a map request thread. Maybe we should just start a leaderhead request thread.
Well, fine for everyone except for the people making the leaderheads. You have to have somebody.
A lot of the work that people like Steph and Quintilis and Embryo Dead, I think it is, that first started looking at the hex editing to make different terrains available, without all of this sort of behind-the-scenes work that people might not recognize that play a scenario, it wouldn't even be possible to think about doing a complex scenario that takes advantage of these things that are buried in the code.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of breakthroughs since the game was introduced, and the guy who invented Flickster, I mean, he might be our all-time hero. What was that guy's name?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
I mean, I'm not an artist in the least bit in terms of graphics and stuff, but...
I agree with you entirely. I don't remember his name. I should.
Moenir?
That's it. That's it, right? Moenir. Yes, you're right, yes.
Saying that right.
Yes, that's right. I mean, such a simple little program, but so vital. Or, you can probably guess what I'm going to say is so important as well as Kimboat.
Yes.
Who's been absent a long time, but I think actually when I joined, he was kind of getting going. You know, he really showed what you could do and created the figures and the props and things to do it with. There's a lot of work like that from back then that people are still using now.
You know, we're talking about behind-the-scenes people a little bit now, or people that laid the foundation. They contribute so much, whether it's giving hints or contributing to a scenario or making something. And the one I just thought of was Aris de Borg with all of his sound work. Most people know him from his terrain set, but I don't know how many people are aware of all the naval units that Delta Strife has put out and a lot of other things people have done that Aris did the sound work on.
Oh, yeah, he does amazing work. I steal shamelessly from his terrain.
He's got that thing posted in his thread about asking permission before you make any alterations. And in some of the terrain work that I'm doing that hasn't been posted yet, I've had occasion to ask him. He has never, ever refused permission. I think he's one of those people that just wants to be aware of what people are doing with his stuff. Another person we haven't mentioned yet is Shiro Kabiria with all his great leader heads.
Without him, there wouldn't be a Western mod in progress, you know. He did all those great leaderheads from the 19th century. Of course, I put a lot of Rob's leaderheads into that project, too. Because you do great 19th century stuff, Rob.
Oh, thank you. One guy that I've mentioned here is Dan, who is Steve Army, who created a lot of leaderheads as well. He did some really good stuff. I always thought he did the best backgrounds.
Yes.
Fantastic.
He's such a nice guy. He's always been cheerful and positive and really an asset to the place.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great guy.
I'm glad that he got mentioned. Really good all around. When you look at the Golden Horde mod, and he did that basically completely by himself.
Pounder, who was pretty much my introduction to Civ Fanatics, just because of his crowded signature, you know, to all the very, very first thing I did on Civ Fanatics was go through everything he had posted on his signature.
Right. But he's posted so much, he had to pull things out of his signature. And I was really frustrated when he first did that because it meant I had to use the search function.
I can't think of a mod that hasn't got some of Pounder's stuff in. I think he sort of set the standard for certain things. You just had to include some of his stuff in. It's just so good.
I've always gone to his stuff.
Loves to try something new, which I really appreciate.
When he started posting stuff with the terrain, with the clouds and the fog, to get the effects that he shows, it takes so much work to try to match what he does.
I like some of this very subtle stuff, like the bones in the desert.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
I think that Ozymandias definitely deserves a mention.
First name that popped into my head, talk about people who are sort of on the fringes of this without creating anything. He's like the essential advisor. He comes along at just the right time and says, what about this?
Right.
And it's always the perfect suggestion.
I think most of the really good work that people have done on the scenario level wouldn't be there without our archivist.
That's very true, yep.
Done a job over the years that I guess maybe people don't really pay much of attention to.
And when the database was hacked and a lot of the stuff disappeared, I think about 90% of what we were able to recover came from his storage, what he's got.
His archives.
Yeah, his archives. I definitely do not mean it as a criticism about Jonathan's Africa scenario. I always forget the name.
The Desert and the Mountain.
Yeah, Desert and the Mountain. That scenario is really frustrating for me to play compared to Age of Imperialism because the map is so small.
I'll tell you why I did that. I did that deliberately. And the reason I did it was because I was very impressed by a scenario by Quasidemo, the Lord of the Rings one. He did it with very few assets. I don't think he had any custom assets at all. He just used the existing graphics. But he did it very well, and the map was much smaller. I mean, you'd think Lord of the Rings, you'd think a great big sweeping epic map with everything on it. But, and I liked it, you know, it felt oddly epic in a way, because everything on it was more important. So on a scenario with a larger map, you know, larger in terms of how many tiles it's actually got, you can have masses and masses of cities and masses of units, and none of them is really all that important because there are so many others. And I like the fact that in that scenario, you could have an epic struggle for one city that really, really mattered because that was the choke point where they were going through. So I was trying to replicate something like that with the African scenario. Even though it was a large area of land, much larger than in my Anglo-Saxon scenario, I tried to make a smaller map where the player would be forced to pay more attention to what was going on, you know, and really defend this particular city. Or really capture that one or whatever it was because they would be more meaningful. I don't know if I succeeded, but that at least was the deliberate intention that I had with that decision.
I think you did a good job on that.
Mm.
The frustration for me is a personal frustration because I tend to like really large maps in general. I sort of developed this playing style where I build up my culture and wait for someone to attack me and then go gangbusters. And it doesn't work on that map. If I try to build up my civ, next thing you know, I've lost half my cities and I don't have access to resources and I'm pretty much gone within about 20 turns.
Well, you know, it sorts out the sheep from the goats, that's the way.
I thought one thing that you did with Rude and the Dragon, which was really clever, was the invaders, where you told me that you had them needing to build a unit using three particular resources that were only available in Britain, and that's how they would invade, because they're desperate to get at these resources. I thought it was quite a clever idea.
Well, that was the theory. I so wish we could have had scripted events because I wanted the Vikings to invade at a definite time and cause havoc, and they just wouldn't. And so that was one thing I tried, putting resources invisible to the player, useful only to the Vikings in the areas where I wanted them to invade. And sometimes they did. I mean, you know, I tried so many different mechanisms to get that to work, and none of them was really quite foolproof. I mean, you know, one could say that's part of the interest. You never quite know if they are going to invade or what, but it was difficult, definitely difficult to try to force the game to do what you wanted it to do that way.
I thought it was very interesting actually as well, being completely immersed in that Anglo-Saxon world, and I think it was probably the best civilopedia I've seen of any scenarios that I've read. And I thought it was really well written, especially with all the different poetry items as well, and extracts from Beowulf, etc. So I was really impressed with that.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you to say so. I did make a special effort with it because I had played a number of scenarios in the past where they were great scenarios, but there wasn't much information in the Civilopedia. And, you know, I like browsing through those things. And I think it's what gives it the feel, you know, gives it the atmosphere. Because basically, we've just got a bunch of pixels on the screen. And you can have the best unit graphics in the world, but ultimately, they're just a bunch of pixels beating each other up. It's our imaginations that give it life. how we imagine it to relate to whatever world we're creating. So I did want to try to evoke the world as much as I could, and that's why I included a whole load of quotes from Beowulf and other Anglo-Saxon works. Those were what sparked my interest in it. You know, it's a great language, great concepts, great stories, and so I thought that might spark other people's interest too, and I think it did.
Your level of immersion, Jonathan, is outstanding. I think that that's complexity of the Civilpedia and all that, the multiple layers and the immersion that you give the player. It's great work.
I think the same thing is true with Anno Domini.
I was kind of influenced by Jonathan's work and how good the Civilpedia was. I found as well, with my methodology of working, when I was working on Anno Domini, did all the bits as I went along, if you see what I mean. If I created a unit, then I also, at the same time, did the Civilopedia entry for it. I think a lot of people didn't do that because they were so hooked upon rushing out the next version of the mod that I missed out on some of these bits that do make it quite important, really. Jonathan was just touching on the concept that it's our imaginations, really, that are very important when we're playing these games. And when you think about it, in a sense, El Justo, your games are in the industrial times, my mods in ancient times, there's mods that are base mods, but essentially we're playing the same game because we're working towards text that will give us a bit more science and all the different things that are available in the editor, possibly in a slightly different order. But it's the theme that really makes it more interesting. Because why shouldn't I play an industrial scenario? Probably because I'm not really interested in that era. But actually, the game itself will probably be very, very similar to a similar game that's set in a different era.
I think that's one of the most amazing things about modding Civ is that we're using the same game engine.
Yeah. Escape from Zombie Island is a great example. Well, in fact, both of those scenarios you just mentioned, both of them are examples of people really doing something new with a game engine, something that it wasn't designed for, but with great success, and it is so difficult to do that. What Pintilapia did with Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire was really quite astonishing. He finds a way to basically channel the player to play in a particular way and for particular things to happen and really follow the course of Roman history. The detail he put in it, of course, is what makes it come alive. And I think even more so, the Escape from Zombie Island, King Arthur, who is a great scenario maker, who inspired me quite a lot in the early days as well. Taking a game that is as constrained as Civilization III and using it to make something that not only looks different, but genuinely plays differently as well. You know, that's the great thing with that scenario. It's not just we're going to call the cities buildings, we're going to call the armies individuals, and that's the only difference. It actually feels like a very different sort of game when you're playing it. And that was, I think, very difficult to do well. Such a brilliant and original idea, and of course Balzacan took it and ran with it. But again, that's obviously something for which the game engine was not designed at all. But they found ways to do it, and it was difficult, but it works. Brilliant. A lot of the work he's done on polishing other people's things as well. I mean, he's proved a lot of my units and things, and a lot of other people's as well. So he does some really good work, and he's very, very accomplished at it.
He was a technician in his prior life, dental technician, so he was used to working with precision stuff. He applies that to everything he does.
He really took me to another level when in terms of scrutinizing stuff, and not just graphics, just multiple levels of stuff, and I owe a lot to him.
I want to make a scenario that would appeal to different sorts of people.
My interest.
There again, you know, like Jonathan was saying about reflecting the particular culture in the scenario that you designed, the Indians sort of have this approach to history where it's not so much a chronological list like we would do in Europe or the United States. For them, there's this connection back to the myths that turn into myth. I just wanted to include that in the scenario, which is probably why it went. And now it's on the order of 15 years I've been working on it.
It's like Rambushan, the Rise and Fall of the Mughals.
Right.
Is that how you pronounce that? I've never actually known how to pronounce that. Anyway, he was working for a while on the idea of a scenario which would be set in the Middle Ages, but it would be set in the mythology of the Middle Ages. So it would be set in the world as medieval people believed it was. So the map would be based on the Mappa Mundi or something like that, and there would be mythological races in other countries like dog-headed men and lemmies and things like that, and centaurs and so on. But it never made it, unfortunately, but I always thought that would be quite a fun scenario if it had ever happened.
It would be fun.
Everyone has their own style of working, too, though. if you've got the Spider-Man scenario going on behind you, it's not quite the same as being able to sit and go piece by piece by piece by piece.
That made it interesting. It's kind of in the background at the moment, but the group work that we did on the steampunk scenario was really interesting because with three of us, you know, King Arthur and you and myself, with our styles being so different, it's made for a really interesting kind of partnership.
Yeah, that still exists, but it needed more skill than I had at the time to bring to actual fruition. So I've got on the back burner.
Right. Same with me.
Here's the one thing I think that Boldacon and Escape from Zombie Island accomplished that a lot of us have never really been able to accomplish correctly, and that's the scope of a scenario. And by that I mean just the way he's able to hone in like that, the scale that he zooms in down onto, and the map itself is a city. For me, I not necessarily encounter stumbling blocks trying to get down to that scale, but the way he has fleshed it out is just really impressive. Takes it to another level, so to speak.
There again, it's like you get busy playing that scenario, and it's so wonderful to play. But then as a modder, I see all these things. It's like he completely worked out land transports, which is so difficult. And then applying terrain to an urban setting, you know, he's done some amazing things there.
I give him props.
Yeah, absolutely.
I believe it's the little incidentals that make a terrain work. Not so much the overall thing, but the little things, the little grass that sticks up here and there.
That brings me to a whole new topic I'm sure we could all relate to, is going back and looking at our own early work. I know I'm really embarrassed. I'm really
scared
embarrassed.
Too.
Yeah.
Don't help dare you.
Yeah.
You're right. It is interesting. And at the same time, we see how much we've grown as creators and artists and assemblers and such. But it is a little difficult to go back and look at the original stuff for sure.
When people create a scenario, I mean, use one of my very old leaderheads, which I think is not quite as good. And I think, well, I did a much better version, and other people have, but no, they prefer the original poorer version for some reason. I don't know why that is.
Sometimes people see something in a piece of work that you don't. I've sometimes used older versions of units in preference to later ones that the same people have done, just because they weren't necessarily better, but they look more like what I wanted.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We can be our own worst critics sometimes.
I think that's true, because Shiro Kaburi, I'm pretty sure it was him, he recently posted something about that he needs to go back and redo all his units. And my first thought is like, no, create new stuff. Your old stuff's good.
Yeah. I mean, Kyriakos does the same thing sometimes. You know, he creates a new sort of style of doing things and says, I must go back and remake everything. And well, you know, sometimes I quite like the old style.
Very true.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe those of you that have actually done scenarios and posted them might want to talk a little bit about the work in progress part of doing scenario design. What that is like to post something that you know isn't finished and have people tear it apart.
Well, I'll tell you my experience on that is I've never really been one for WIP threads, mainly because I would always try to spend any kind of time chronicling or reviewing spent with the editor and all that stuff. With that said, within the last couple of years, I've kind of changed my course a little bit just because the game is so old. And if I can post updates on there in the public forum and it generates some enthusiasm and some posts, that's great. I do it now mainly because it's almost classic.
Yeah.
All the internal stuff, the nitty-gritty decision-making that would be within a group of a couple people, I never really got into that a whole lot. I just didn't think it would be interesting to people, so I would keep it out.
Well, see, that's where I disagree. I think works in progress are very interesting. I wish more people would post works in progress.
Well,
I think for everything that's posted, there's got to be 4, 5, 10 things that are in progress under the surface that nobody sees.
I think a lot of it back in the day for me, and I'm going back a bunch of years, was the stigma attached with opening up those threads and then the projects die.
Right.
So I never wanted to attach myself to that. And it was more of a superstition than anything else. But I think that that was part
of it. See, I had quite a different reasoning for it myself, which was far more egotistical. I didn't like to present anything that wasn't done. And so I wanted to maintain the illusion that my things were sort of springing into being kind of perfect. You know, like...
part of my thought process.
Like,
sure.
For each of my scenarios, the two scenarios I made, and also there was another one that I intended to make but never finished, I did a preview thread sort of fairly early on where I said, this is what I'm planning, here are other ideas and so on. There were helpful ideas in those, especially the second and third, not so much the first one because no one knew who I was then. But I do fanatically try to polish and perfect things before I present them. And that can get pathological sometimes, that you polish something for so long you never actually finish it or put it anywhere. It was pure ego on my part that I didn't go in for work in progress.
I was in a similar vein to that, to be honest, myself, in that I didn't want to post anything that wasn't complete. Also, I'd created leader heads in there that I wanted to be only available with a completed version, rather than, you know, suddenly people getting half of the reason why they wanted to download it was maybe to steal some of the stuff. I didn't want that. But until I was ready with a completed project. And I think there was a lot of people, certainly at the time, were posting such rushed versions of things, just full of bugs, and I didn't really want to be associated with people that were creating things in a 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Just so they could get a comment or two about how it was. Well, it's unfinished. Go back and finish it.
The early days were like that, to a pretty big degree. Loaded with bugs and not much thought or passion put into it.
I think that's okay if it is actually a work in progress and they continue to make changes, but there's a lot of stuff that gets posted and abandoned.
I'm talking about in the early ages when Civ 3 was still on the shelves.
I see.
And not Civ 4. Very early ages. I don't want to knock anybody for trying to put something together for the community, but a lot of it was intentionally rushed, to rush to get it to the market.
Right. For each of us, the most bizarre scenario idea you've had that will probably never get made. For me, I don't know which of any of you are familiar with the Church of the Subgenius, but I've got this idea for this really weird 1950s Cold War scenario mod, but with the Men in Black and the Reverend Bob Dobbs Church of the Subgenius thing where a whole religion has been built out of the 1950s ads. I can hear by the chuckle. You're like, make it, dude. I want to play that.
I, for a long time, would be fantastic to make a Doctor Who scenario in London using the Escape from Zombie Island sort of approach. But there just aren't the units, and I never really had time for it. And I know people have tried similar things, but I thought something like that done with all the detail and everything could be fantastic. But, yeah, I never had time to start on it, probably just as well.
I've tried to lay out a London map several times, and the problem is that the streets just don't go in the right directions.
I can't think of anything bizarre to contribute, to be honest with you. But doing ancient mods, I'm really sorry, I haven't got anything that's out there that I can suggest.
Well, that just goes to show you're the most sane of all of us.
I guess the one quirky thing that I've always wanted to do in the back of my mind was there's a great Native American history here in my region of the state, all within the Delaware Valley, which is the Philadelphia area in South Jersey and southeastern Pennsylvania and parts of Delaware. The British, the Dutch, the Swedish, a variety of different European colonizers came into contact with a group of Indians based out of this area here, and it's good local history. Wouldn't really be in the same chapters as my large, grand scenarios that I do with all the different countries around the world, but that's probably about as exotic as I've ever brainstormed.
Well, I made those autumn trees for a Sleepy Hollow scenario idea I had once.
I suppose, really, if we're talking bizarre, I was the guy that brought out a Jasmine Delaunay lead ahead.
You certainly were. We all remember that.
Yeah.
I guess that was probably as bizarre as I got. Funny, looking back at a very old leaderhead that I didn't do, but drifted many, many years ago, and it was Maya.
Yeah, I remember that dude.
Yeah.
Leaderhead creating was the Eurocommon that he did, and it wasn't using anything like Poser. It was just a couple of the existing leaderheads that he'd kind of amalgamated from Firaxis. But I prefer that leaderhead, Kekkonen, to any other sort of leaderhead for Finland for some reason. Just got some sort of attachment with that. So it's interesting.
I guess I'd say another group of people that we haven't really talked about too much that really paved the way for us was a lot of people that did cut and paste work or changing pallets work early days, you know, where it's like cut and paste part of one for access unit over a part of another unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bebro is one that comes to mind that did a lot of really early work that maybe isn't up to modern standards, but I don't think any of us would have accomplished what we accomplished without people like that.
Well, it's still being done. Gwendolyn used the cut and paste technique on his recent flamethrower unit, getting the flames right.
Yeah, and that's a very nice unit.
That's where archives like Ozzy's come in so handy. It's raw material.
That's true. He is good about that. You can ask him a very vague question, like, once upon a time, wasn't there a unit that had some flames? And he'll give you three or four.
I hope he never uses his powers for evil. You know, it's quite impressive, these memory powers.
Do you think there are different contingents in the subgroup? The people who like the graphics and gameplay versus the people who just like the military possibilities of it?
Well, there's definitely radically variant styles of play. When Conquest first came out for the Mac, there were a few of us that decided to do one of those succession game things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was totally shocked. I was totally shocked because my style of play sort of build really slow and build up the culture and that sort of thing. And having someone a couple turns later try to take over an entire another civ in five turns, because we were doing five turns and then pass it on, it was a real eye-opener for me.
Yeah, I had some good experience with SGs too, and man, I learned a lot. From pure gameplay standpoint, I definitely learned a lot.
I've never done that.
I think the big benefit for me, coming back to thinking about designing scenarios, is I want to make something that's interesting enough that people with a completely different style of play will still enjoy it.
Yeah, it's just like life. There's wide variances of tastes and so forth. Different tastes for different folks. That's how I think that boils down to.
I kind of got that idea when I was creating Anno Domini. People have different ways of playing it. And I felt that one point, certainly in the earlier days, Civ 3, the differences between the civs were mainly down to the units and a little bit to the attributes given. So that's why I built in different buildings that almost like unique buildings
right.
that each civ could build.
Yeah, you could differentiate it a little bit more.
Yeah. And I thought that was important for people that might want to play a Civ that was more based on a military aspect. One of the reasons I did Anno Domini the way I did, with the different tech screens for different Civs, a different way of playing for the Indian Civs, for example, which Hugh Bruce helped with quite tremendously.
Thank you. One way that modding has helped me a lot with playing is that there's some really nice scenarios, like we were talking about Rambokan earlier and the Mughals scenario. I'll play that version, his version, straight, but I also made a version for myself where I could play a couple of the non-player civs. And the way that scenario is structured, you can't win, but I kind of set my own goal of, like, being the spoiler. You know, it's like, okay, I've got these pirates, and this time around, I want the French to win, not the British. So play it that way. And I think that's kind of fun. Maybe that's something that, whether I ever make a finished scenario or not, being in the community and knowing enough about it to tweak someone else's scenario just to play myself is a lot of fun.
Brings me on to a question, which is, if you are creating a scenario or a mod, do you think that it's important for all the civs to be very balanced, or do you think it's good to have some civs that are more difficult to play and easier to play?
I think it's a fine line. I've always tried to straddle both sides of it. I'll use the Age of Imperialism as an example. You know, the Ottoman Empire in 1895 wasn't really in a spot to challenge German Empire in terms of economics, and so there is a little differentiation in that regard, but at the same time, you want to try to not completely imbalance it, so you got to kind of straddle it.
Another thing that Age of Imperialism makes really clear, and I've seen it in some other scenarios also, is that placement on the map makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
Some of those civs that might seem marginal, because of where they're on the map, can last at least until the middle game, and I think that makes it interesting.
Well, I think a lot of people who play this game have played Risk before.
Right.
And know the value of starting off way down in Australia, I think it is.
Yeah. No one behind your back. Right.
It's the same way. There's a couple different scenarios playing on the South Asian map that I think it's one of Rob's scenarios, where the Harappans sort of start off on the corner and they don't have a lot of the strengths the others do. But if you can get built up early in the game, it's really survivable. Where if you stuck them in the middle of the map at the beginning, they would just get wiped out in the first few turns.
I tried to balance in my scenarios as well, and I found it very difficult. I mean, I don't think there's a problem with having some cities that are just going to be easier than others because of their size or where they are. But one problem is that you can never be sure what unseen effects there are going to be from the decisions you make when you're designing something.
Mm.
And so I gave myself a kind of a ridiculously difficult challenge in the desert and the mountain scenario, where I had different groups of cities with completely different technologies and units and paths to victory. I almost made it like several different scenarios kind of jammed together, because I wanted to bring out the very different situations and the different parts of the area that it covered. And it was staggeringly difficult to do, because any tiny change somewhere in the game would have all kinds of ramifications elsewhere, maybe for other civilizations and so on. I think I managed it more or less in the end to have them all more or less balanced. But balance and variety are kind of enemies. You know, you can have it incredibly balanced if you have every civ exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And you can have it incredibly varied, but there are going to be huge imbalances of power between them. And getting it right is a very, very difficult task.
Well, that's got to be tougher for you guys who are doing the historical scenarios, as opposed to like when Bruce and I were working on the steampunk scenario. You guys had to try to duplicate history,
right?
Whereas we could go off in any direction we want.
Right. When I deal with folks in the threads after I'll release something, and they'll not really henpeck about it, but they'll bring to light certain decisions that we made in the gameplay process of straddling the line, and I always fall back on, if this is the way history laid it out, then this is the story that I'm trying to tell. And, yeah, we take a little deviation from it and go down a path where you might try to balance it some, but they'll ask me why the Ottomans can't compete against the same size civs like Germany or so, you know, in that vein. And I'll say, look, man, this is the way it was. It's almost like a fail-safe fallback in that history. This is the story that was written.
There again, it's a question, like Jonathan was saying, of balancing the civs. A scenario that I play over and over and over again, I really love it. I'm like Rob in that I tend to prefer the ancient era, is the ancient Mediterranean.
Yeah.
My favorite civ to play is the Trojans. And every other civ has a civ-specific wonder that really gives them a jump by the time they build that. Well, the Trojans don't have that. What they have instead is a third civ trait, and it really seems to balance it out well.
Gives you a little variety, too, as far as playing it, and replayability and so forth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I work oppositely to you, John, in regards to the reality side of things. In the mods that I create, because they're very ancient mods, starting off in 4000 BC, it's all about what could potentially happen.
Well, I think you have a little bit more room for license freedom.
More flexibility, because you're starting off back in that time. And of course, people have mentioned to me, well, it seems ridiculous that a little tribe of British farmers can beat the might of the Roman Empire. And that's true in one respect, if you're looking at from a purely historical point of view, what did happen. But the Romans were farmers back in 4000 BC, so there's always the potential for, you know, any of those groups to become involved into an empire. One of the other things that's good, of course, going back to, if I were to create a leaderhead for the industrial and modern era, people would be able to say, well, that's not very realistic because there's a picture of that particular person and we can match your leaderhead to the picture and it doesn't match up. Whereas in ancient times, no pictures exist of Thames et al., so
true,
I can do what the heck I like.
True. I think you're being a little hard on yourself there.
Rob, when you were saying that, what I was thinking of right away, we were talking earlier about Shiro Kamuri's leaderheads, and I really bugged him and bugged him and bugged him until he made this Emperor Norton leaderhead. And it looks nothing at all like the photographs, other than the hat that he's wearing. But at the same time, I think he really captured the spirit of that guy.
Yeah, I remember that. That was great.
I guess what people have hemmed and hawed about for me is like individual stats for like battleships and cruisers. And it's like, I scratch my head when I open up the email. So someone notified to your thread. How can you put this when they only have 3 sets of 4-inch guns and this ship has 6-inch guns and they're in quad turrets? And yeah, I'm thinking to myself, there is rhyme to the reason. I mean, we open up the spreadsheets and we figure out why we chose certain stats, but you have people really like to get down to the nitty gritty of it.
You know, those of us that are perfectionists, I think we get too caught up in that. I remember one time Cheryl Kaburi and I had a pretty intense discussion about the particular curve of a sword on a unit. And I'm aware of at least one discussion that involved 3 or 4 people about not having the proper buttons on a uniform. And you see it in some of the large previews that people do. And it's like, those are really cool previews, but by the time you scale it down to what you actually see in the game, that stuff's invisible.
When I did work on the Cold War and the Age of Imperialism, there was a guy on the forums, his name is Clyden.
Yeah, I remember him.
He's been there a long time. He used to work with that guy,
Okate. Yeah.
Awesome dude. He and I would correspond via email. And he helped me out with all the stats for the specs of the ships and the planes. And, I mean, you name it, I would leave it to him. And he would take the spreadsheet list and, you know, I would give him the skeleton of the outline with the classes of units. And he would fill in all the stats and he would have a specific rationale for why he would make certain stats more. He would go on to the forums and I would give him free rein to defend himself and his decision-making process. I never would have been able to get down these scenarios if it wasn't for him in terms of the guts of a scenario. So he was always a top-notch dude for me. Under the radar type of guy, just a pleasure to work with.
At a certain point, we all have to let things go, whether it's having the wrong shape of buttons on a grenadier's uniform or not matching my favorite photograph of a historical figure, and look at the spirit of things and whether it fits in with everything else in the particular scenario.
Well, it's a question of how much resources you can put into it and time you can put into it. You can get very into the weeds with all the stats and all the low details and find yourself working 10 years on something that may not have taken that long if you didn't pay attention to that minutia.
Right.
The thing is as well that you can be working on a game for ages and by the time you finish, it's out of date, you know. Things have moved on.
Yeah, but you know what, Rob? That's where I'll get back to my righteousness of El Justo. I don't want to come off as crass, but I don't care. For me, I'm not busting your chops, but I'm just saying, like, for anybody else, like, I do this all intrinsically, and to get it done and to put it up there, it just has a value unto itself to me.
Oh, I totally agree with that sentiment. I mean, for me, I do mods because I want to play the game myself. I'm not really worried about what other people think about it.
In the same breath, I'm encouraging you, you know, like, don't be so hard on yourself.
Right.
Stuff that we really love and enjoy, for as corny as that sounds.
No, I think that's precisely the point. Over the last few years, I've had the chance to be around a few professional game designers, and they all come back to the same thing, that ultimately you have to make the game that you would enjoy playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it.
I think otherwise you won't get that passion you get for modding.
You're right.
And I think a lot of the greatness out of some of the mods that have been created in the past, you can tell that the author is real sort of enthusiastic about the setting, going back to Jonathan's work with Rude and the Dragon and Desert and the Mountain in particular, you can tell a real passion they had for those different subjects.
Mm.
Same with you and the Age of Imperialism. All comes through. And it wouldn't if it was just something you were doing for other people's enjoyment, not your own.
Thanks, bro.
Or Escape from Zombie Island Complete.
Right.
Which is passion in a different direction. You're still fine-tuning it.
Crazy man.
Well, I don't know if it's because of the type of scenario it is or what, but working on that model of film series, film sequel is perfect because we've all got a version to play while he works on the next version. You know?
Yeah.
If he had held off, you know, if we had never seen Escape from Zombie Island and we were still waiting for Escape from Zombie Island 5 or whatever it might be, it would be frustrating.
Of course, I find myself, this isn't ready yet, this isn't ready yet, this isn't ready yet. And I admit experiencing like this huge inertia pushing back at me from just saying, I'm not ready to put this on the website yet.
Right.
Just going back to the Civ 5 work that I'm doing at the moment for Anno Domini, I've had to put up a version because, unfortunately, I've been ill for a year, that people are wanting a Brave New World version of Anno Domini. So I've had to put something up there to say, look, I'm working on this, guys, you know, there is work that's going on, just to not shut people up, but to give them something to play, and to feedback on as well. Sometimes people can play the game and spot things that you just missed.
Sure.
The future of modding Civ 3.
I think as long as we all kind of stick around and there's a decent number of us left actively on the forum, one of us will get the itch.
A fellow posted on my Mars Terrain thread recently where he says, well, I just like to do dioramas, taking the trains and whatnot and the units and setting them all up and then taking a picture of it.
If I ever get one of these scenarios finished, I'll have to have him do the screenshot when I finally get it posted.
Yeah, which shows the dear variety of stuff that's actually being done.
Yeah, and you know what really amazes you? All these people that might come in, or, you know, you see all this new stuff just continues to roll out. I mean, it's not at the same pace as it was years ago, but for a game that's been inactive for, what was it, 2005 when Civ 4 came out? You know, we're almost at 10 years now where the game hasn't been actively the premier game by a Civilization franchise.
So I don't see it really going anywhere. One way or another, I find ways of putting something into it if time allows. So from my end, yeah, I don't see it going anywhere.
I'm pleased to hear it, yeah.
Well, a few years ago, someone, I can't remember who now, someone gathered some statistics on the forum. Both when Civ 4 and Civ 5 came out, there was a dip in the number of postings and so on in Civ 3, but then it bounced back and stabilized. And as long as there's a stable community, we'll probably be okay on that aspect.
And I think as well, as long as people are coming out with some fresh ideas like they are doing, then it will keep it thriving as well.
That's probably the secret. I'm glad to see that new people continuously come in. I'm really glad to see that. One of the reasons I jumped in and took over the monthly competitions was because I think that that's the community building project. I'm big on community building. I think that's important to what we do.
There's always new people coming up. There's always new people getting into it and finding it. I think as long as people want there to be modding, there will be modding.
Have any of the units from Civ 3 migrated up into Civ 4 and 5?
It is just about possible to do. If you have the models that you used to make the animations, they can be turned into models that can be used in Civ 4, Civ 5. So Rabbit White did that with one of mine, just as a kind of demonstration that it can be done. But it's a ridiculous process. It's just not feasible because the style of model is different. Just everything about it. It's not worth it, basically. Just not worth it.
Which unit was that?
He did it with my Prospector, I think. I gave him the model, and he fiddled about with it and sort of posted some shots and animations of what he'd done. But I don't think he released it as an actual usable unit. You know, it wasn't even possible to do that, really. It could be done in theory, not to be recommended.
Double work, half the reward.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
The process is absolutely ridiculous. You just don't get the same quality anyway. A lot of the modified units for Civ 4 and 5 are really reskins.
Yeah.
But apparently we can steal shamelessly from them.
Yeah, Tom2050 has done a lot of work of taking models from more 3D style games and re-importing them, transferring them, making them into Civ 3 units. And it's not simple. Basically, he ends up taking the model and completely reanimating it.
I think one of the strengths of our group is that people with old equipment can actually play this game.
Well, yeah, not just to play it, but to mod it. Until Quintilis added mapping to his editor, the only way for me on a Mac was to have parallels so that I could run some of the old utilities like bitmap to BIC.
Yeah, it works like a charm.
One of the things I've noticed over the last few years is whether it's new modders or people that just have questions or problems about playing a mod, it seems like there's a lot of people that lurk and have been lurking for years, and then all at once they're active on the forum.
Oh, yeah, it's always been like that. Yeah, for every person who makes a comment on a thread, there are any number of people who download the thing without making a comment. So there's surprisingly high interest beyond what you actually see, I think.
Guys like Tony Bosca, I think that's how his name is pronounced.
Yes.
What a great addition to the group he's been.
what amazes me is I've noticed just within the last 6 months or so, there's people that show up and are suddenly active that have been lurking for years. We didn't even know they were there. And to me, that's one sign that the interest is still there in modding Civ 3 is the fact that people go beyond just lurking.
Mm. It is kind of neat. You know, all these years later and poof, here they are.
We're getting old enough, I think, as a group where we're starting to bring other people in, like daughters, sons, relatives, friends. And that's good. That keeps the group healthy, I think.
I registered to the forum just because of what you did here, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I lurked around the Cybernetics site for about a year before joining.
There you go. There's a proof in the pudding that lurkers sign up and lead to bigger things.
Conversely, there are those that sign up just to get a 10-year-old thread and say, have you thought of doing this with this unit? And it's like, well, yeah. No, the creator hasn't been around for like the last 8 years, so maybe not.
The same way with some of the WIP scenarios, you know, the work in progress scenarios. I've seen that too. It's like a 10-year-old thread gets bumped. It's like, I can't download this scenario. And, you know, I'm thinking it's like because it was never posted 10 years ago.
They're doing good work.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you two things today. First, whenever anyone bumps one of my threads from years ago to say, great unit, I just think, good, I'm glad someone still likes it. I'm not too bothered by it. But second, it can sometimes lead to things, because we were talking about Escape from Zombie Island. Well, that got bumped. That was a scenario that had been released by King Arthur and kind of disappeared into oblivion. And someone did a necro thing on the thread. And someone just passed by, and the discussion started getting up. King Arthur came back and had another go at it, and then Voldekin got in. So sometimes thread necromancy can actually lead to new stuff happening.
The closing of SOC.
I have the sense that a lot of the people over there were modders, and that had a big impact on the modding community.
Yeah, the guy who set that site up, Marine Corps, he's another one who's from back in the day. He helped do a lot of archiving and didn't work with the database. He set up his own site over there and paid for the server and all that. And going back, he asked me to come over there to see if I could put some of my stuff on there. And it was a godsend for me because I used that server to house all my stuff. So when the site went down, I had to make sure that I retrieved it all because that was my lockbox for it all. It was a great little site, almost like a way station of Civilization III stuff. Mike kept that server up for a while. He put his own resources into that. And I asked him a number of times over the years if he wanted any money or I'd help keep it going. And he always said no. So sad to see it go. How long was it there? Probably close to 10 years.
Right.
Well, I used it for the same thing. I used it to stash a lot of stuff I was working on in case my computer crashed. And a great place to show works in progress.
One of the things I noticed is that there were some interesting conversations over there before people were willing to, or ready, I should say, to post WIPs at Civ Fanatics. It was almost like an alpha site before you were ready to post your betas.
Yeah, there was a small group of regular contributors there that I guess were all kind of like-minded, and it was a good place to, like you said, Bruce, to bounce ideas off of one another.
Sort of a quieter, more serious place, though.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, you know. There wasn't much peanut gallery over there.
Yeah, well, you would be able to connect with a more direct group of people that you can enjoy their feedback more than the commoner, so to speak.
Yeah, I think if you got over there, you were serious to begin with. If you found the thing in the first place, you were already into it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a casual, you know, I've been here twice and I'm going to lay down my opinion.
And we were talking about lurking, too, and that was the place where I lurked. I think I made one or two comments the whole time that site was up. But having been invited or discovered it or something, it was kind of cool being able to listen in on conversations before other people in Civ Fanatics saw what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I even had my own private forum there when I did AOI. We had a development playtesting forum where it was about a half a dozen of us where we posted playtest reports and fixes for certain versions and so forth. It was a neat little place, and I was sad to see it go, but that's life.
I was very into SimCity at one point, actually modding that before I ever came to this game. There's a term for it, but a cautionary tale is the SimCity 3000 community, which used to thrive. They had tens of thousands of buildings posted, and all that just disappeared off into the ether. A couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to grab enough buildings to do the Manhattan terrain before that happened, but I could never do it now because that whole community vaporized.
Wow.
Gone.
Wow.
And there's a cautionary tale for us.
Sure. Hopefully, Civ Fanatics is going to stick around for quite a few years.
Oh, I don't think it's going anywhere for the time being.
It's kept fresh with the different versions of Civ, the different iterations that come out. More general to the actual whole franchise rather than specific.
Yeah, but that's my point. There's a new version of SimCity out, of course, but that old version, that SimCity 3000 database, is gone.
Right.
And we might feel a responsibility ourselves, because we're part of this Civ 3 community, to keep our database, and to keep everything there, but it depends on us being there to do that.
We all started modding because, well, we wanted to make mods.
Right.
We kind of got drawn into a community. I think it's absolutely true. We've all known each other for, well, many, many years, I suppose, though this is the first time, at least for me, that I've spoken to any of you. But some of the people we've met on the site have really stuck with us. And I was so reminded of this just a couple of days ago when I was looking through some of Storm Rage's threads. You remember him?
Yeah.
He was a very lively and visible presence on the forum, talking about people who don't actually create anything themselves but provide a lot of inspiration. And he was like that. And he died several years ago, and that was a huge shock. Still something I think about. And it really brings home to you how real a community like that is. How important it's been to us all, and I think we've all experienced that.
Yes.
It's funny sometimes going back to old threads and you find Storm Rage and Space of One's comments.
I'm always reminded of Space of One when I look at my own units, because I made that beaver worker for him. You know, he was the one who started all of that with his Narnia mod idea.
Mm-hmm. Which is in the Christmas tree terrain that I made, why there's that one bonus terrain that has the lamp in the middle of the forest. That was kind of an homage to Storm Rage.
There you go.
Because he was the first person that ever posted something, a direct comment to me that really encouraged me. It encouraged me enough that I put it in my signature at one point.
Hmm.
It wasn't even some extraordinary comment or anything. It was the first thing that really encouraged me when I started feeling, well, do I really belong here? Jonathan made the comment about friends. I never really understood that whole internet friend thing until I became a member of this community. And now I have to explain to other people how I can have friends that I've never met or spoken to.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting dynamic of everything, for sure.
Calling today in North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY.
Don't worry about it, sir. This fortress is impenetrable. There's absolutely no... Huh?
Ah! Ow!
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com. For more information on Modcast, our sibling shows Polycast, Redcast, Civcast and Turncast, or about Polycast in general, log on to the series official website at thepolycast.net.
If there's anything about Voldicon's work, whether it's units or something else, it's not typical.
Yeah, but my point was going to be I drive him crazy making changes because I'm an experimenter at heart.
You're definitely an experimenter, and I'm kind of halfway in between because I love experimenting, but I'm also a perfectionist. You give me these great ideas, and then I got to go off and figure out how to do something pixel by pixel.
Yeah, I'm the mad scientist, not the field guy.
What's that make me, Igor? There again, one of the problems I've had with doing things like working on the terrains is because my time's kind of spotty. I have weeks where I'm super busy and then weeks where I have a lot of time. I forget what I was doing. So like I've got 100 layers in GIMP and it's like, okay, which layer was I working on?
Well, what I do now, I didn't do it with Civ 3, but I certainly do it with Civ 5, is I keep a logbook of exactly what I've done, what I need to do next. It just works that way. And then I can just keep up to date with everything.
I'm sitting here chuckling, Rob, because you obviously don't have a background in computer programming.
I don't.
Yeah, see, in computer programming, it's an unwritten law that you're forbidden to do any kind of commenting or tracking your work.
Oh, right. Being organized has always worked for me, though.
Maybe we'll just have to bug you the way we've bugged Shiru with some requests for leaderheads. Maybe that's something you can manage to fit in.
Maybe so. I'm a little busy with Anno Domini at the moment, but, you know, I wouldn't want it out.
Like we were saying earlier, when is being busy ever stopped us?
Don't always need to refer to it, but it's useful to have it there. Then I know exactly where I'm at.
We were talking earlier about balancing real life with the modding work.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan had mentioned about it being a sort of intellectual relaxation. Well, I've started doing this thing. I call it the thing because there's not really a good name for it. I've kind of shifted academic fields, and I'm working in anthropology now. There's some really good work that's being done. I'm aware of it both here in the United States and a group that's in Berlin, people doing anthropological work, including participant observation in virtual worlds. It's like, okay, I'm sorry if I offend anybody, but I'm forced to play World of Warcraft for academic reasons.
Someone has to do it.
And when I get through with my World of Warcraft sessions, it's like I get up from the computer and half an hour later, I'm playing Civ.
It drives you back to the game.
Yeah, exactly, because it's relaxing, but it keeps my mind sharp at the same time.
Oh, I got addicted to World of Warcraft while I was doing my PhD as well. I don't know how I finished that thing, but yeah, I got pretty far in it.
There was a scientist a few years ago who said, well, you know, the possibility that the world is a game program is perfectly plausible, at least in a metaphysical sense. The thing is, I'm sure that whoever's running the world now isn't working with game engine restrictions.
Not ones that we're aware of, anyway, but then I guess if you were a leaderhead, you really wouldn't know what game engine you were stuck inside of.
I think if you're a leaderhead, you've got more serious problems on your
hands. Like getting out of that frame.
Exactly. A game like Civilization is a model of the real world. I mean, it's a very simple model, and it's a model that's distorted in important ways because it's a game, so it has different purposes. But it's no different in kind from far more complex models people use to try and understand history or archaeology or physics or anything, really. So, yeah, why not?
This is probably a good place to stop, otherwise we'll go on all day long. One last thing I would like to say is that we've mentioned a lot of names of people, but there are a lot of people that we didn't mention, and it's not because they're not valuable, it's just because there's so many amazingly creative people that we couldn't list all the names.
True. Absolutely.
True.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the strength of the group right now. We've got a deep bench, and I think that bodes well for our future here.
Well, bye-bye, you guys, and hopefully it won't be this long before we get a chance to have a conversation again.
Thank you for organizing it, and yeah, it's been great.
It's been pretty cool.
Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye, you guys.
All right, guys,
okay.
Take care.
Take it easy.
Take care. Hello?
Hi, can anyone hear me?
Yep.
Excellent.
So is that Jonathan?
That's me. And who's that?
It's Rob. I think that Bruce is also recording it, so we've got a backup.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, well, it looks like we've got a problem with him. Are you getting that message from Bruce?
I thought probably John was coming as well.
He said he...
Hello, is that John? Hello?
Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you a lot more clearly now, Rob.
Oh, good.
We got Jonathan and Bruce?
I think so. I was just speaking with Jonathan just a moment ago.
I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. Does that mean we've got... Are we all here at last?
Hey, Jonathan.
We've got all four of
us? Yeah,
I
think
is that Bruce as well? Hello, Bruce. Are you here? So who's here, then?
I'm here.
Good. That's Jonathan. Bruce, are you here?
That's probably a no.
I think it is.
I wonder what Bruce is up to.
Okay, I think I'm back. Can you guys hear me?
Oh, no, we can't.
There he is.
I'm joking. We can't.
Everything was fine. Then the minute I started the call, my microphone went completely dead, even in my Mac system preferences.
That's weird.
Well, technology, what? Can't
yeah.
live without it. Can't live with it.
Exactly. Exactly. Speaking of...
Can I just ask... Oh, there's a problem with the call now, so... Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Yeah, I can get you guys. Did he fall out?
Yeah, I think we're back again now. Are you still with us, Bruce?
No, he's got... no, maybe he's back. Are you back?
Yeah.
Right, good stuff.
Okay.
You think between us we'd have enough technical know-how to make a Skype call, wouldn't
right.
you?
Hello, are we all back?
I am. I'm not quite sure what happened there.
Yeah, well, obviously what I was saying about Native American mob was so interesting.
You broke the internet with it, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
It started breaking up while Rob was talking, and all I got was a lot of sounds like it was underwater, so I don't know if it was clear.
It's the Leeds accent. So that was a bit choppy.
Yeah. It's really choppy.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
I just got a message from John saying...
Seems to be a bit problematic, this call, isn't it?
I can hear you just.
Yes. There's a bit of makeup.
I'm sure you all remember, and certainly in the earlier days, that... we all cut out again.
We've probably all got different bits, so if we send them all, then he can, like, reconstruct them in an act of incredible scholarship, basically, and kind of patch together the perfect podcast from the imperfect sources or something like that.
Yes, that's what Dan had asked me, for everybody to send him the bits and pieces. None of us have done this kind of a thing before, so we're probably going to step over each other's voices a little bit. But since Dan will be editing, I don't think that's much to worry about.
It isn't. When he edited the one we did the other week, it came out in a completely different order to how we'd actually taped it. Sounded more logical, the edited version, I must say. But...
Well, good luck to him, that's all I can say.
Yeah, well, you know. It often seems that when you're doing a mod, all the cool stuff that would have been useful for it comes out like 3 or 4 years later. So,
so maybe Rob wants to talk about that a little bit.
Maybe he does, I don't know.
On the academic side, I know times when I've been really busy with classes and independent studies, independent research projects and things, I keep having this feeling that, oh, I should drop this class because then I would have time to mod.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
My wife can tell you a few stories. She could probably write a couple chapters of my life story about Civilization 3.
My wife, I think, probably, let's not let them get together. They mustn't meet. They probably have a lot.
That's probably a good idea.
Jonathan, you keep saying your first scenario, your second scenario, but you haven't said the names of them.
That's true. I should put in a plug, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Well, French historians would say that.
Yes.
But it's true.
Oh, fringe. Fringe, not French.
Right. Sorry.
Maybe for
Freudian slip there?
Yes. And I still owe Jonathan a cup of coffee now that I remember. So.
Well, that's proving interesting.
I found as well with my methodology of working when I was working on Anno Domini, I can't even pronounce my own mod now, Anno Domini, was that.
But on the other hand, if you don't want paratrooping monkeys, you know, if you don't want flying monkeys in your ancient India, then you can do, you know.
Why wouldn't you?
Well, you know.
Because no one's made a flying monkey unit yet, that's why.
True.
I hate to keep bagging on you, Jonathan, but the very first time I played Rudin the Dragon, where are all the dragons? This is called Rudin the Dragon. Where are all the dragons?
Well, you see, that marketing, that is.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Balthazar just came online.
Oh.
So I think we're all going to shut up for a minute and let him add something onto what we've been talking about for the last, hour and 45 minutes.
So I haven't actually heard what you've been talking about.
Be grateful.
Yeah, be grateful, exactly. About the first 45 minutes of it was continually dropping and joining the conversation because we were having some audio problems.
The steampunk mod started with, and I hate to dominate the conversation here, but the steampunk mod started with...
I want to interject here and say don't worry about dominating the conversation because we've all had a chance to chime in on some of these key things. And plus, Dan is going to be editing this extensively. So
you can cut me in at appropriate point.
Exactly.
That's right. I'll show my best side.
The other thing as well is that since you've come on, the connection has been perfect. So, you know, something's going right. No cutting.
Don't say that, Bob. Don't say it. It's just tempting fate.
Oh, right. No, sorry. I'm sensing providence, aren't I?
Whenever you guys need to drop out of the conversation, you know, don't feel like you have to hang on. I think the three of us in the United States can continue talking.
Well, it's only 4:20, so it's not bedtime yet.
Oh, good.
I'm fine for a little while.
Good.
We want to keep a bit of sense injected into this conversation as much as we can.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Got that. Guys are a bunch of rascals.
Sense from the country that gave us the goons. That's a good thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
That was before we were born, though.
Yeah, you can't trust them. You never know what they'll do.
Wait a minute, who is that that just said that you can't trust them?
I don't know. That was some kind of gremlin in the machine. That was nothing to do.
Okay. Okay. Now you said it enough, I recognize the accent. That's got to be Jonathan.
Yeah.
Okay, that topic died. Oddly enough, Womack's terrain was the starting point for all the terrains I did.
Right. That shows up a little bit still.
Ought to show up a lot.
It's a hard thing to do, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hard thing to do.
And I'm sorry if you guys heard my cat scream.
Yeah, I did. That's cool.
She has this bad habit of, when I'm sitting at the computer, sitting directly under my feet. Going back to the movie metaphor, you're kind of at the director's cut stage on that scenario.
Which one?
Age of Imperialism?
Yes, it would be the director's cut. You're right. And maybe I can try to put it on Blu-ray. But yeah.
The Canadian government actually sponsored a thing about using Civ as a classroom tool, and Civ 3 mod was a big part of that.
It was done by Aglo, wasn't it, who we also haven't mentioned.
Right. We're coming up on 3 hours just on this one conversation, and I think we could go on forever, but we do need to wrap it up at some point. And Dan posted his email, so whoever has a recording, go ahead and post it to him. I've got bits and pieces done by two different programs.
I'll send him what I've got, but there's some chopping, maybe about 6 different files.
Well, I've got one massive one. It's now 3 hours and 45 minutes, so he can have fun rummaging through that.
Record date, July 20th, 2014. Civilization 3 Clips Copyright Info Games Atari.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net. Thank you.
Yeah.